Welcome to a Prevent Connect audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 22nd at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
I'm going to be in front of you for about a half hour. Just want to talk to you about the role of batterers programs, because a lot of times when we talk about the response to domestic violence in particular, men's violence against women, and how that gets manifested in the relationship between men and women. Because if we look at men's violence against women, we really have to look at it as the manifestation of sexism. So if sexism didn't exist, it would look much differently. So when we look at this, the criminal justice is really the only organized response around domestic violence, right? But we know that out of all of the men in the United States, well, let me ask, what percentage of men do that thing that's physically abusive, that is illegal, the physical assault? About what percentage of men do you think out of 100% of the men in the United States? What do you think? Just throw some numbers out. 10, 40? 30, 70? Well, let's drop the highest and the lowest. The statistics about 20, 25 maybe, right? So when we look at men's violence against women and when we look at men who are violent, there's a lot of men who are violent. Now, we know that while the overwhelming majority of violence against women is men's violence against women, the majority of men are not violent, but they're silent about the abuse that men perpetrate, those well-meaning men, right? And that's a big problem. In other words, those men who are abusive can only be abusive because we allow them to through our silence. So with those men who are abusive, out of those who are abusive, if we take 100% of the men who do something that's illegal, the physical violence, how many of them are actually held accountable for it? How many are arrested for it? Let me say that. What percentage? One percentage. Out of 1%. Out of those who are arrested, how many actually wind up with some sort of a consequence? In other words, they go in front of a judge and there actually is a consequence. 0.1. So we're looking at a very small percentage, right? A tiny amount of men who wind up through the criminal justice system, and because of the inherent problems in the criminal justice system, like institutional racism, they're mostly brown and black men. So we're missing a whole lot of men. There's a whole lot of men doing the same thing that the men who wind up in batterers programs do. And even when they go to a batterers program and they don't comply with that program, how many of them are held accountable? Very few. So formerly, as I was working with Tony at A Call to Men, but I was formerly the director of the largest batterers program in the country for 12 years, up to about a year ago or so, Safe Horizons program, where Juan Ramos is the director now. We had 400, 500 men a week, all mandated to this program. So there's probably been 12,000 men that have gone through the program when I've been there, all mandated men. But it didn't reduce domestic violence in New York City. So that ain't the cure. It's like if somebody's racist or is anti-Semitic, what program would you put them in for that? What treatment would you give them for that? And how would you know if they stop those behaviors? So we need not to invest in whether batterers programs make a difference. There is a role for batterers programs, and I want to talk about that. But I want to talk about the context in which this violence is perpetrated. I'm sorry, my remote here. Okay. Before I do that, I just want to say a couple things about statistics. I'm not going to go through all these. I have quite a few up. But I just want to talk about the reframing and accountable language. These are domestic violence statistics. Every day, what the statistic will say is about 4 million women are abused annually, which breaks down to about 11,000 women are victims of domestic violence every day. What we've done is simply, let's take the focus off of the victim and put it on the perpetrator. It's a much different conversation. It sounds much different. Every day, 11,000 men severely assault the woman. Much different. So men need to accept this. If anyone needs to accept responsibility, it's men. Every 12 seconds, a man is physically abusive towards a woman. Not every 12 seconds a woman is a victim of domestic violence. That's too generic. That's too vague. Men are perpetrating this violence. And I'll go further, that it's not every 12 seconds. They just took that number and multiplied it or divided it by the days of the year, the hours in the day, so forth. Because it's not that a woman's being abused now, and 11 seconds, women are safe, and they can do whatever they want, and nothing's happening to them, and then 12 seconds, another one. Women are never safe. Though they spend most of their time with well-meaning men, they're never safe. So we just want to reframe the statistics that really put the focus on men as perpetrators. Again, every day, this statistic reads in domestic violence statistics that focused on the victim and her victimization or her being murdered, that women are murdered by their former partner. Okay, so each day men murder their present or former partner. Men will rape 1 out of 6 women. It's different than seeing the stat, 1 out of 6 women are raped. Like, well, where did they go? Why did she walk there? Why did she have that on, right? We need to put the focus on the perpetrator. So I think I've said enough about that because I have too much to cover. I'm going to give Jackson Katz a shout out. He inspired me with this one. The need for accountable language. This is Mark. Mark beat Joyce. Joyce was beaten by Mark, is what we'll say. See, Mark's starting to get to the end of the sentence there. His name's kind of getting ready to drop off. Joyce was beaten, but the word we use is what? Joyce was battered, and she'll just go through our systems. Joyce is a battered woman. Where we need to stay right here, focus right here. Keep it right here. So with offender programs, let me first say that anyone who's doing a program is doing it with the best of intentions. We want the violence to stop. My conversation to you is that we just need not to put so much investment in that it's going to, that men are going to stop simply because they go to this program. We all desire for the violence and abuse that's perpetrated toward women to end. We work with the best of intentions in whatever model we have for that violence to end. We all desire change and work in our own way to create it. Programs have a specific place and purpose and role as agent for change. Look at your neighbor and say, men can change. They absolutely can, but it's unlikely that that change will occur solely because they attend a program. Just because they're going to a program, because even if they're in the program with you and you see that the room illuminates, he gets it. By the time he leaves, closes the door, gets in his car, turns the key, that light gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And here he is, the same man at week 26 that he was at week 1 when he turns the key. Same guy. Because he's getting messages everywhere else that say, women have less value. Women are my property. Women are objects. He's getting these messages everywhere. So no matter how wonderful our work is, it's unlikely simply just because he has that, he's getting that from you, that he's going to make changes. And if he does, how do we know? I can be an abusive man. How would you know? Doing this work, how would you know? It's not to say all men are abusive, but we all have the latitude to be abusive and get away with it. We have the social support to get away with it. And we cannot determine at what point, if any, he changes. It might be 2 years from now, and then you say, you know what, this guy's made changes. We cannot determine how he behaves with us based on how he behaves with, I'm sorry, how he behaves with her based on how he behaves with us. So most offenders are in programs due to some sort of mandate. There's not really self-referred men. There's situational referred men. He doesn't wake up and say, oh, I want to go into a program because this sexism is too much, the male privilege is overwhelming, and I just want to learn how to share it. He goes in because he's in a jam. His wife said, I'm leaving, or I'm not coming back with the kids unless. Because what we found in our work was that men don't stay. Once they get out of that jam, they drop out of the program because they're in there for the, right? So that's why it's about mandated men, at least in our perspective. But when you deal with mandated men, you also deal with resistance. Most of the men are sent through the criminal justice system, so they're already resistance there. How many have been mandated to trainings or mandated to do something through your job? Do you like that? You want to do anything but that. Even if it's good for you, you don't want to go because they're making you go. So he's already mandated. And then he already feels like why am I even here? I didn't do what was so bad. If she didn't do that, I wouldn't have done this. She knows how I like my steak cooked. She knows what time I get home. She knows how, right? So it really gets to a lot of resistance in the room. He's not just going there willingly. I'm going to skip through a little bit of this because I do want to talk about this, though. When we talk about domestic violence, out of all that domestic violence is, these are some of what we might define as domestic violence. What's arrestable out of that? What percentage is arrestable? What percentage can the police come to the door for? What do you think? The physical? Okay. So what would you say? 5%? 10%? 2%? All right, let's say 10% is arrestable, though, right? So 10% is something that police can do something about. 90% is not. So you don't need that 10%. 90% of anything is good. That's an A. I don't know. Where's Maya? My daughter's running around. The one who keeps running down here, that's my daughter. She's in college, and I just want to make sure that's a 90 A or a 92 started A. But anyway, it's close enough to an A that you would want it. So 90% of anything is good. He doesn't need to use the 10%. She knows he's capable of the 10%. He's established that. A look can say, you know, I got 10% left. Right? So for us to even measure men who are doing that 10% or focus on the men who are doing that 10%, we're missing the 90%. The tactics of control, power, control, intimidation, instilling fear, all of that, you don't need the physical violence for. It's about power and control. So for us to focus on men who wind up in programs for that 10% of what domestic violence is really missing the point. It's a much bigger issue than this. So when we look at men who come into our programs, there's a natural resistance to men. You know why? They feel picked on, and they're right, they are being picked on. Who here works in a battles program? Do these men feel like they're the victims? Can you just say yes or no? Yes. Wow. So, and they feel that way because they are being picked on. They're the first generation of men being held accountable for something men have always gotten away with. So they're like, wait a minute, who changed the rules? My father did much worse. I restrained myself. You should see what my neighbor did. She didn't even want the police to be called. Bring her in here. She will tell you that my neighbor called the police. Well, because her jaw was broken. And of course you can't call the police, but he'll say that. He feels very justified. He feels very picked on that, and that's where these father's rights and men's rights things say, you're picking on me. What happened to the good old days? Women got too much already. They got a Violence Against Women Act. What's going to be next? Freedom? So, men, I'm sorry, I'm a bit rushed, so I'm trying to fit a lot in, so excuse me. So men are acting out of their definition of manhood. And actually, and this is where A Call to Men was born. Tony was doing work with battlers, I was doing work with battlers, and we were like, man, these guys are the same men that we hang out with. They just got caught. Or they got caught for something that men like us may not have done, but we think about it. Let me say, well-meaning men in the audience, let me just get your hands up here. All right. So, the bad guy, the one who does that physical abuse, and men, we determine, we have a line that we draw, it's right here, and it's always physical. He touched her, if it's sexual assault, he touched her, but we can look at her all we want. We can objectify her with our eyes, we can do all that, but we didn't touch her, so, right? So, but all of that's the same. So, we have this line that we draw, and the physical violence is the same. He hit her, so we have the line saying, we'll even say, well, guys, he crossed the line, where it speaks to our entitlement and privilege that we even get to determine where the line is. See, the line for her might have been way over here. When I started dating him, Dave, and he texted me, I was in class, I didn't text him back for 2 hours, he started tripping. And there's a lot of things happened from this point to our range, 90%. So it's bigger than that. So it's about men acting out of their definition of manhood. He's even saying, you know what? She didn't do what I said. I'm supposed to do something about that. That's what the definition of manhood says. I'm supposed to do something about that. So what's that going to be? And well-meaning men, you're at the table with your wife, your girlfriend, your partner. You get into a little heated discussion, and heated discussions are not bad. It's how we interact. It's the respect that we show within those. Gets a little heated. She stands up from the table, hits the table, and says, you know what? This conversation is over. Now, women, I'm going to, sisters, just hold your tongue. You just, I know you want to say something. But guys, you may not say it because you're well-meaning, but you're thinking, this conversation is over. All right, sisters. Right, now, so you may not say it, but in your mind you're saying, oh boy, she's got it twisted, but I can't say that. But I feel it. That's the socialization that says there's something wrong about that. There's something wrong about that. So, wow. Oh, jeez. Okay. Say, men can change. They absolutely can. I put that slide in there to remind myself because they absolutely can. Okay. We make monsters out of them. We focus on fixing them. I'm going to have to skip through some of this, unfortunately. All right. The violence is, when we talk about mental health, mental illness, those are excuses. Oh, okay, good. All right, good. All right. So, well, I'll stay with this. When we talk about mental illness, those are excuses. Not that men aren't mentally ill, some of us, but it would show up everywhere. It wouldn't just be exclusive and selective to her. If it's about anger management, then it would show up when the police come too, but it doesn't. The police knock on the door after they're hearing him yell. He knock on the door and he's, hello, officer, how are you? He doesn't have to use those skills that he uses with his boss when his boss gets him angry, or with his buddies when his buddy gets him angry, because he's socialized to believe that she's his property and she's supposed to do what he says. You know, when we talk, so it's not about mental illness, it's because it would show up other places. It's selective and exclusive. When I was running this program, I just want to talk about anger management for a minute. I was met with a man because I had to kick him out of the program. And I always meet with, I had two offices at the time. One was downstairs, it was in the administrative office. And then there was a smaller one upstairs where the court office, where the court building, where the courts were. And there were court officers there. So whenever I met with a man, no matter who that man was, I already always did it where the court officers were because, hey, I know I'm kicking him out. He's not going to be happy about that, and I want some backup. So, and this office upstairs was very small, and this man had said he had done something. It was very few men. Out of the 12,000 men, I probably kicked out 50 men over the 12 years. Because you know what? They know how to behave. They also understand rules and regulations. They enforce them all the time. So, I'm meeting with this man, and I know that he's not going to be happy. He had said something disrespectful to one of the women instructors, and we just won't have that, and I was meeting with him to talk to him about that. And when he came in, he was a huge guy. He must have been about 6'5", about 280 pounds, and it was all in the right places, right? I mean, this guy was big, right? So, as he comes in, I'm scratching my head. I don't know if my staff's there. I'm scratching my head. I say, okay, well, in this small office, there's a large chair near the desk, and then there's a small chair at the door, right? So as I'm asking him to come into the office, where do you think I let him sit? No, the big chair right here. Because did I say the small chair was near the door? Okay, I just want to make clear. So I say, you know, you'll be more comfortable in my chair, please. So now, you have to understand now, this is what, you know, I was okay at this point, but as we're into our conversation, and I'm saying to him, you know, you're going to have to go back to the court, to the judge, and, you know, you're no longer in the program. And he says, if I go back to the court, I'm going to jail. And his fists go like this. Now, his fists look like they just got really big, right? Really big, right? So as he's doing that, I'm saying, oh, boy. Now, you have to understand, I want to put this in some context, and I say this whenever I tell a story, I'm a little hesitant to say this because it's like a man box thing to say, but it helps you understand where I was. So I try to keep, you know, take care of myself. I also train in the martial arts. I'm black belt karate. So I was, you know, I'm generally feeling pretty confident in being able to handle myself. But I wasn't. I used to say, Tony, I was concerned. I was scared. Right? I'm scared. I'm sitting there like, oh, sugar. Right? So I'm scared. This guy's swelling up in front of me. Right? Even more so. And so I'm saying, okay, well, you know, and we're having a little dialogue, and I'm saying, you know, really, that's all I can do. It's my final decision. And so I stand up and step out, right? And I'm measuring, not measuring what I can do. I'm measuring the distance from his swing because I know I can't get to him, right? So I'm stepping out. And I'm kind of saying, you know, Mr. Smith, we'll call him, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, that's my final decision. And he walks out, and I'm still measuring, give myself space. And he's still like this, veins popping out of his neck, teeth clenched. And he walks by me and says, I hope you reconsider, and walks out. And I said to my staff, that is anger management. He don't need no treatment, no therapy. He knows how to manage his anger just fine. Just fine. So it's not about that. It's about I don't have to use these things because in the same way that the way that you interact with your children versus someone else's children are different. And that's the way these men are socialized to say, you're supposed to do what I say. So men know how to be respectful and have all of the capacity to stop being violent. Men already possess all the tools and skills needed to be appropriate and non-abusive, and they use them in their daily lives. Systems of accountability. In New York, I'd usually get some dialogue from you here, but I don't have the time. In New York, 15 years ago, if you got a DWI, very little happened. Very little. Now in New York, you didn't get a fine necessarily, not all the time. You didn't get your license revoked all the time. There were very little consequences. Today, though, you get your license revoked, there's a fine, there's a public humiliation. In other words, if your coworkers know you got a DWI, they are almost ashamed of you. How can you let that happen? 15 years ago, they might have been like, oh, did you make it home? It wasn't the same social stigma. Now, we didn't get together every 30 days to learn how do we respond to somebody getting a DWI. We were socialized in the last 15 years to know what was right and what was wrong and so forth and so on. So today, in New York, you get your car taken away also. It's seen as a weapon. You get your car taken away, you get your license revoked, you have to pay a fine, there's a public humiliation, you have to go to a DWI course, and there's general embarrassment, right? And you got to ask people you don't like for rides because you can't drive, right? So if you go to someone at the end of the year when they get all these things back and you ask them, what is it that impacts you most? Why won't you drink and drive again? What do you think they'd say? Sorry, shut it out. Public humiliation. They want their car, right? Well, they would get the car back, but they couldn't drive it at that point. But yes, the car, license. Where's the DWI program in that? Doesn't really matter, does it? Well, there's a lot of good work that happens in batterers programs. But as far as the role, a batterers program is like is to the domestic violence field like a DWI class is to DWIs. Stuff has to happen other than that. Right? So now in Nassau County, this is what they do. When people are arrested for DWIs, that's in the newspaper. Now, this is not to say that men don't need, out of the 12,000 men who went through our program, how many of you think needed therapy or counseling? 12,000. We got about 300 people here. How many of you think needed counseling or therapy? About 300. So it's not about battering. Everyone needs a little sounding board now and then, but I'm oversharing. So what needs to happen is, so counseling might help, therapy might help, but that's not why he's abusive. You know what? Changing sugar, you know, you might want to reduce your sugar too. You might want to cut down on the caffeine. You might want to get into the gym. There's a lot of things you might want to do. And it's not that men don't need healing. Joe Erman, was Joe Erman great yesterday or what? Let me tell you, I fell in love with Joe Erman. Tony and I were in Maryland. I fell in love. Every time I see Joe, I give him a hug. I love you. I'm always like Joe because I connect so much with this guy. And we were on a panel, and I heard Joe speak for the first time, and he's a tremendous speaker. But he shared something, and I'm paraphrasing. But he was talking about a relationship with his father and about men and about how we pass on our socialization to our boys and so forth. Really, you know all the stuff that he said yesterday about how tender it is about fatherhood for him. He was talking about something related to his dad and said, I had a hole in my soul shaped like my father. Oh, my goodness. I almost fell back in my chair. No one had ever said it like that. I was like, whoa. And all men that I know have holes in their soul shaped like their father. So these men may need some additional support, but it's got nothing to do with why they whooping her down. Hole in my soul shaped like my father. Now, our goal is to not put holes in our boy's soul shaped like us, right? Okay, so I got about 3 minutes left. Let me just take you to one more thing. Violence against women is the manifestation of sexism. No doubt about it, whether you want to believe it or not. Even though it's cloudy outside, the sun's still shining, right? So you can say, there's no sun, right? It's the truth. Tony showed you this. The foundation. Men as a collective, violence against women, all of this is built on it. Sexism supports that. Patriarchy supports that. Collective responsibility, men. Just two quick points. The collective responsibility. Can I just give you all a demonstration of how we're going to end men's violence against women? I don't care what program you have. Any man in that program is going to benefit from this. Can I just tell you how? Okay, I got to come down here with you, though. All right, so a man in my community is abusive and violent toward the woman in our community. And now it's not a secret anymore because domestic violence was always seen as a private issue, right? Well, who does that serve? Who benefits from that? Men, right, because in a private issue was because it was about English common law. Everything that happened in that man's house belonged to him. So now it's no longer a private issue, right? So now when it happens in our community, men in that community have a collective responsibility in the same way that if we, as strangers on the street here in New York, saw somebody get into their car with a bottle of liquor staggering, we would have a collective responsibility to do something where 15 years ago we might be like, oh, we better get out of the way. But today we know that, you know what, if we don't do something, it's on us. So this collective responsibility looks like this. So the man's abusive in our community. And I go to David, my neighbor, and say, David, did you see the ambulance out there? It's a shame. We got to go talk to John. I get David, I get Mike, and I get Forrest. And we go and knock on his door in love and in peace. We're not going in violence because that doesn't solve anything. We know that, right? And we say, John, men in this community don't behave that way. You need to stop it. And we did this in my community. And when he drives down the street, he doesn't drive down anymore, chilling. He drives down like this. He has a different awareness. Now, it's not to say that he's not going to be abusive. We don't want him to be abusive to her, closing the door and saying, don't ever, you know, whatever batterers say. We don't want that. But there's a social response here, so it's a different environment. So now, he goes to work. And Luke, Andre, and Craig, and what's your name? And John, greet him at work and say, hey, man. We heard what happened. Men who work here don't behave that way. You need to stop it. So now he goes to his church or a synagogue or his mosque. What's your name, my man? Stefan? Stefan, Carl, and David. Greet him at the church, the synagogue, or mosque and say, hey, men who worship here don't behave that way. You need to stop it. Do you think he can stop it? He has to. Got to do it. So now he goes, who plays golf here? All right. Your name? Kevin, David, and Randy. They're on the tee. I don't really have a good swing here. But here they are. John's with them. They're on the tee. And Kevin says, as he tees off, hey, check this out, John. It's the last time we're going to play, man. You do this again. We're not going to play anymore. You can't hang with us. You need to stop it. Absolutely, he can. That's the collective responsibility, that we're giving messages that we're saying it's not acceptable. And you can stop it because you've been angry with me before and didn't take a swing at me, right? So it's a collective responsibility. And then I want to just give one example of creating systems of accountability. This will be 1 minute. Systems of accountability. Systems of accountability. We need to create systems of accountability to hold men accountable, not just the batterers program. The batterers program has its place. The criminal justice system is already organized. We need to do a better job in the criminal justice system. And batterers programs do very good work. The only thing is that I'm not even saying that men don't make changes, but this is the issue. If I put 10 men up here from my program, you ask me to pick the 10 who I think made changes, I'd pick the 10 who sound good to me, who make me feel good about what I'm doing, and they might be the one who has it tied up to the radiator while he's in class. How do I know? That's not what we need to worry about. In the same way that, who stopped drinking and driving? I have no idea. But I know that I like to speed when I drive. I got to tell you, I got a heavy foot, and I got a ticket. Do you think that stopped me from speeding? Well, of course it did. But when I see the police, what do? Slow down. Right? So I get it. You know, you ain't got to tell me but once. Same thing with men in our program. Oh, I get it. I better use that 90%. So create systems of accountability. I just want to give one example. Tony and I were in an upstate college responding to this community who had a rape on campus, and they were really, everyone was very engaged trying to figure out what do we need to do to make the campus safe, so forth and so on. Everybody was involved. Student groups, teachers, deans, security, the cafeteria staff was there. Everybody was really concerned. So they're talking about security and safety and said, well, we need to get more. They said that we need to get more vans because when the sun goes down, we want to be able to provide transportation for women around campus. If they go from the dorm to the library to the cafeteria, so forth. So we're like, well, what if women were free to go wherever they wanted to go, whenever they wanted to go, and any man going from the cafeteria to the dorm or the dorm to the library, he needs the escort. It ain't women who's raping women. But women are always inconvenienced for the violence that men perpetrate. And we always look at it as risk reduction instead of primary prevention, which we're talking about. Risk reduction. So Maya, is Maya in here? Okay. Maya, when you go to college, watch where you put your drink. No, we should be saying, boy, what are you putting in somebody's drink for? What are you putting in somebody's drink for? What are you doing putting something in someone's drink for? That's premeditated rape. Did you know that? So it's really about, but we don't put the responsibility on men for men's violence. We put the responsibility on women for men's violence. So I know I'm preaching to the choir, but we need to put the responsibility on men for men's violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.